The matter of State versus Rivas, can we please have appearances of counsel?
James K. Smith Jr., Assistant Deputy Public Defender, appearing on behalf of Abayuba Rivas.
Good morning, Deputy Attorney General Regina M. Oberholzer, on behalf of the state.
Good morning, may it please the court, Jason LaBeouf on behalf of Amicus, the ACDL of New Jersey.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Smith, please go ahead.
Your Honor, with the permission of the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
That's fine, and I just ask you to try to keep your voice up, please.
Your Honors, this case presents the issue of whether remarks which a defendant made during the course of a statement, which was later suppressed due to a Fifth Amendment violation of the right to counsel, may be used to show that somehow he reinitiated questioning the very next day. Now, in this case, the judge did suppress everything that the defendant said on March 18th. The issue before the court is whether two statements made on March 19th must be suppressed under the rule of Edwards versus Arizona. Now, Edwards versus Arizona, of course, provides that if a defendant in the course of questioning asserts his or her right to counsel, questioning must cease. This court somewhat expanded that in McCloskey and Alston to hold that if the defendant makes ambiguous statements about the right to counsel, the police have two choices. They can either stop the questioning, period, or they can stop and find what is the defendant's intention. Is he really understand his right to counsel, and is he waiving it? In this case, the police did neither. They simply plowed ahead with the questioning. Now, under the Edwards rule, if a defendant asserts his or her right to counsel during an interrogation, only one of three things could happen. Either an attorney is actually made present and available for the defendant, the defendant is out of custody for 14 days, or it is the defendant who reinitiates the questioning. And that's the issue in this case, reinitiation. Now, I would point out also that the Edwards rules continues as long as the defendant is at least incarcerated prior to the trial. There is no attenuation, as the state argues. Now, in this case, the judge found that the defendant's statements about having a lawyer were, quote, objectively unclear and ambiguous. The judge also found that the detective's attempts at clarification were insufficient. The state does not disagree with either findings. And it's clear that the detectives did not stop the questioning. Rather, they continued to question the defendant for several hours. And as I point out in my brief, during that period, the detectives said on a number of occasions that they planned to take the defendant, once he was medically cleared, out to find his wife's body and the missing suitcase either that night or the next day. Our position, of course, is none of this questioning should have ever taken place. Now, the state argues that the reinitiation here occurred, quote, after the statement was over and the detectives ended the questioning. The trial judge found basically the same thing. However, I think that a look at the last 5 or 6 pages of the interrogation clearly shows that, number one, the questioning never stopped, and number two, that the defendant's statements about wanting to talk to the detectives the next day were interspersed with their questions about the case. And I'm going to refer specifically.
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
The trial court suppressed all of the March 18th statement or only that portion up to the so-called reinitiation?
All of it. There was no qualification.
So that included the so-called reinitiation?
Yes.
So if that was suppressed, how can that be considered for any purpose?
I think you're asking the wrong party that question.
But are you making that argument that if it was suppressed, then it should not be considered?
Absolutely.
You said just a moment ago that the questioning never stopped, if you look at the transcript. Can you explain that?
Well, okay. I'd refer, first of all, to page 393 of the appendix, which is the defendant's statement. The defendant says, I want to talk with all of you three.
And he also says, keep your voice up and a little bit slower, please.
Oh, okay.
Repeat the page number, please.
Page 393 of my appendix in the appellate division. Okay? Defendant saying, I want to talk with all of you three, but okay, if you come tomorrow, I want to talk to you. Okay? On page 394, the detectives then tell defendant that they are going to take him tomorrow to find the suitcase and the cell phone. On page 395, the detectives...
If I could, this, what you're reading to us now comes after what the state has asserted was the defendant's request to reinitiate in the future, or am I mistaken?
I would submit that's not correct, Your Honor. That, in fact, this goes, the 393 citation is where the defendant first says he wants to talk to you tomorrow. After that, there are repeated statements by the detectives over these next five or six pages of transcript about, well, you know, tomorrow we want to look for the suitcase and...
That's the point that I was attempting to make. What you're reading to us follows from the defendant saying he wanted to talk with them tomorrow.
That's exactly correct.
Let's call it the alleged reinitiation at this point.
Okay.
My question to you was... Up until that point, you said the questioning never stopped. What are you relying on in making that assertion?
The fact that there's several hundred pages of transcript after, I think it's on page 32 of the my appendix, where the detectives stop asking him questions and they stop talking about whether there's going to be a lawyer. And the one detective says, can we talk about Carla now? And from that point on, it's all about the facts of the case and did he kill her and where's the body?
So help clarify one thing and make the record a little bit more understandable. Here's what I understood, and you know it better. Miranda warnings are given at the outset.
Right.
Then there is an extended period of questioning, as you've just said. And then at some point, a doctor comes into the room and conducts a medical examination.
Right.
And then sometime after that, the defendant allegedly asserts a desire to reinitiate afterwards. How much time had elapsed from when the interview stops and the doctor begins an examination until the examination concludes and the defendant says what he says on page 393.
I can't tell you the exact time because that's not in the transcript, but I would say at least 100 pages of questioning after that.
No. 100 pages of questioning after the doctor's exam.
I'm doing this off the top of my head, but that's my recollection, yes.
Okay, I think the doctor begins his exam, according to the transcript, around page 385, line 21, the doctor says, okay, I'm just going to examine you, okay, and he's been in the room a little while. So my question is, tell me if I'm mistaken, when does the medical exam take place, and how long is the doctor examining?
Okay, I did misunderstand your question, because I was talking about the part earlier where the giving of the rights is interrupted by his desire to go to the bathroom and they, you know, have people coming in.
I'm asking about the doctor's examination. How long is the exam about? I understand that you can't tell us precisely right now. Is it 2 minutes? Is it 5 minutes? Is it 30 minutes? About how long is the examination?
Again, I can only speculate. I didn't get the idea it was long. I got the idea that the doctor just sort of came in and asked a couple questions, but
There's a video, or there's an audio recording of this, though.
Yes.
No?
Yes.
So would that affect the analysis if it demonstrated that the questioning did stop at some point and there was a medical exam before the defendant makes the comment about speaking the next day? Would that affect the analysis?
No, because as soon as the doctor left, they resumed it. And the, as I said, there was some questioning about the facts of the case all the way up until the point of page 3.
So page 292.
Yeah.
If I, just reading from it, the doctor says, and you just come out, and then the detective tells the defendant, I think we're going to leave. And then we come to the language that you read on the following page, 393. I want to talk with all three of you, and so on. Your position is the questioning was continuous, and that the doctor's exam has no moment in the analysis. Am I understanding you correctly?
Well, I'm not arguing certainly that he wasn't competent to give a statement.
That's not my question. Your position is, if I understand it, the questioning continued throughout, and however long this medical exam was, it has no bearing on the analysis. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. I mean, clearly the detectives were still there while the doctor was there because they were still, you know, this
would
that part about...
Would it make a difference? There are two doctrines that are at play here, as I see. There's Edwards, and then there's Hartley and O'Neill. Tell me if I'm... In Edwards, there was an assertion of counsel, and then there was no questioning. And then the question was whether there's reinitiation. This case involves a case where there was not a strict observance of the Miranda rules, and there was a statement with many incriminating remarks. Even if this statement was not continuous and it was broken by 10 or 15 minutes, then the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine would apply to what occurred 15 minutes later. Am I mistaken?
Well, no, but...
So it's either continuous and it's out, or this 15-minute break is meaningless because of the fruit of the poisonous tree. What occurred for hours earlier polluted what occurred afterwards, break or no break. Am I mistaken?
No, but I think I would go.
Is there a case where the fruit of the poisonous tree in New Jersey, where the fruit of the poisonous tree has applied to a rekindling of the conversation, a resumption of the conversation at the behest of the defendant? In other words, fruit of the poisonous tree we see many times causing the suppression of evidence. But this is something different. This is the suppression, I suppose, is what's being argued, of an effort by the defendant to resume the conversation. So do you have any case law that says fruit of the poisonous tree would disallow consideration of an otherwise, for the sake of argument, valid restarting of the conversation by the defendant?
No, my answer to that would be that in State versus Wint, this court specifically held that where there's a violation of the Fifth Amendment right to counsel, that is not done under an attenuation analysis. It's done under Edwards versus Arizona.
Right, but that's not quite what's being talked about here. This is essentially the questioning is dealing with the concept that fruit of the poisonous tree bars a subsequent effort by the defendant to restart the conversation with the police officers. And what I'm asking you is that in our law somewhere?
I can't cite a case for that. No.
Well, Mr. Smith, I want to bring us back to the conversation with regard to the doctor coming in and interrupting the interrogation. So my reading of the transcript is on page 367, the doctor comes in and indicates that they want to do a quick psychiatric evaluation, at which point Detective Smith says, I can come back in a bit, and the doctor says, okay. So indicating that the detective was going to be coming back to continue the interrogation. And it's also my reading that Detective Guzman stayed in the room the entire time with the doctor and defendant, seemingly to provide some sort of translation for defendant speaking Spanish. So we have a situation where the defendant at some point ambiguously invokes. The interrogation doesn't stop as a result of that. The interrogation continues, and the stopping point really is the doctor coming in indicating that they will be doing an examination, but the officer saying that he'd be back, and an officer staying in there the entire time. So do you think in that circumstance that there was actually a break and a stoppage in the interrogation?
No, not at all. That's, as I said before, obviously there were police officers in there. They were still taping it. The fact that a nurse came in or a doctor came in, you know, back and forth, none of that stopped the interrogation. The process continued.
And Detective Smith saying that he would come back in a bit didn't indicate, okay, we're done here. He indicated he was going to come back after the evaluation was complete, but another officer stayed there the entire time.
That's correct. So
Even if there was a break, the next question is whether he is exercising from a free and unconstrained mind what occurred for hours going on earlier.
That's correct.
That's the whole point of the attenuation and fruit of the poisonous tree. So whether it's continuous or this little break should not seem to make any difference under our jurisprudence. Am I mistaken?
No. I mean, my position, of course, is that both the Supreme Court of the United States has said that if there's an assertion of the right to counsel, and this court has said that if a defendant makes ambiguous statements about the right to counsel, the interrogation must cease.
But is it insignificant when it's an Edwards? You're arguing it's an Edwards violation, right? And in order to assert that there's an Edwards violation, you need continuity, don't you?
And I'm not sure what you mean by.
I mean, you the break may mean that there is no Edwards violation if there is a break, correct?
Wrong. It's that again. There would. No matter whether you're talking about, you know, this court's decisions in McCloskey or Edwards, either way, you're talking about what's necessary to reinitiate. And that has to be actions on the part of the defendant.
Right.
And not simply a situation of the defendant sitting in a hospital room while detectives are going in and out.
No, I'm not. I know you're arguing that there was, that he did not reinitiate, but the timing and the break is important to that analysis, is it not? I understand your position that there was an Edwards violation, but the timing is important, is it not?
No. Let me just say that Edwards versus Arizona, as I said, is a continuing violation that if a defendant asserts his right to counsel, the police have to stop the questioning, but they can't come back tomorrow and resume again. Edwards, as I said before, continues until either the defendant has an attorney present or he reinitiates. So the break doesn't matter unless, in fact, it is the defendant who reinitiates at the end.
The basis of Edwards and Wendt is that the reinitiation is based upon a free and unconstrained mind from what previously occurred. In Edwards, tell me if I'm mistaken, Edwards, there was an invocation and it was honored. When it was also honored, there wasn't questioning afterwards. That's what makes this case different.
Right.
There was an assertion that the trial court found, and then there was hundreds of pages of interrogation. That's what changes this from the typical Edwards case.
Right. And as I cited in my brief, I cited an 11th Circuit case, United States versus Gomez. Now, there's a lot of cases out there on reinitiation, but all of them assume that at some point there was a stop in the questioning, which could be just momentarily, as in I cite Fuller and Moore in my brief, but that at some point the questioning stopped. And this case of United States versus Gomez in the 11th Circuit said that basically all of that, this reinitiation question is irrelevant if the questioning didn't stop. That, you know, there's no reason to consider reinitiation if the police just plowed on in violation of the guy's Fifth Amendment rights.
Mr. Smith, I don't quite understand the argument that you're advancing right now. I think you have a stronger argument if, as you've said, there's continuous questioning, and then the defendant says, all right, I want to keep talking to you, in the midst of a stream of continuous questions. That doesn't mean that you lose if there's some bit of a break. But as I look at this transcript, I don't see continuous questioning leading up to the language on page 393 where the defendant says, I want to talk with all three of you. Tell me where I'm mistaken. You've read for us passages after. You've conceded there was a medical exam before. Is there, as you understand the facts and the record of this case, nonstop questioning leading up to the so-called reinitiation?
Well, I think that continuous questioning and nonstop questioning are two different issues.
Is it continuous questioning where the officers, to use your words, do not stop asking questions? Doesn't mean you win or lose, but I think you're arguing something that is not borne out by the record.
Let me respond in this manner. This went on for several hours. Let us assume that in the middle of it, all of a sudden, instead of talking about his wife's disappearance and the location of the body, they go off and they start talking about baseball for 10 minutes, okay? That doesn't stop the interrogation, nor does, as I've argued before, the fact that medical personnel are coming in and out of the room, or that one of the detectives leaves for a few minutes. It was nonstop questioning. The topic may have changed at times, but the interrogation continued over several hours. So that, I mean, other than that, if you and I are reading this transcript differently, that, you know, that's all I can say.
You don't see a difference between officers changing subjects and continuing to ask questions on a different subject and a doctor asking questions as part of a medical exam?
No, I don't. As long as the police officers are there and they haven't stopped the questioning, and then it doesn't matter, as I said before, whether people are coming in, whether doctors are asking questions, whatever.
Well, if they're not asking questions, they've stopped the questioning for some period of time. They haven't announced we're stopping questioning, but when you say they haven't stopped the questioning, it appears that there was a period of time in which the doctor was in charge of what was happening in that room.
Okay, and then great. As soon as the doctor left, then they resumed the questioning. So the interrogation did
with
not.
With what question did they resume the question?
I can't, without getting out the transcript and reading it to you.
I mean, we're.
Mr. Smith, as Justice Alvin noted earlier, this questioning, unlike all the other cases we've been discussing, Edwards, Wynn, Chu, Bradshaw, all those other cases, the interrogation at some point stopped because the defendant invoked his right to counsel. And there was the discussion of a reinitiation was in the context of a defendant stopping, the police stopping the interrogation, advising the defendant that the interrogation was being stopped because he had invoked his right to counsel, and then making a determination of whether the defendant, having that knowledge and information in mind, reinitiated the interrogation. That did not happen here at all, correct? Whether there was a break because the doctor walked in or because they started talking about baseball, this interrogation, unlike all the other cases we're discussing, did not stop because there was an acknowledgement of defendant's right to counsel. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct. And the point here, of course, is that this entire 2-hour period of questioning should have never taken place in the first place. They shouldn't have even, for that matter, been in the same room, and other than doing a booking question or something. But none of this should have happened. I'd like to go back a little bit to,
I think. And that's the point. Once he invoked his right, that's a simple point. Whether there was a break or not, no questioning was permitted. And you advised us that the trial court suppressed the entire statement, including the so-called reinitiation.
And including the doctor, for that matter, yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out, if that's been suppressed, then how can it be considered for any purposes?
I'd like to go back to a question which you asked earlier. I mean, I think my answer to that question is obvious, but to go back to refer to a question before, the fact is that reinitiation under State versus Chu is a two-step process. The first step is the defendant must be inviting discussion of the crime for which he or she was being held. However, there's a second step, and that is that the defendant must, in fact, understand his or her rights at the time they are reinitiating. Now, what you have in this case is a rather extended period of time in which the defendant is going back and forth and making statements about, you know, maybe I need a lawyer, blah, 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 blah. But the fact is that at no point was it established that he understood his right to have counsel present or that he was waiving it. The trial judge did not find that to be the case, and nobody has. So what you have is a situation where this 2 hours later, when he's talking about, I want to talk to you or whatever, that at that point, they still haven't established that he understands what he is waiving.
And even if there were a break, and I'm going back to some of our jurisprudence in O'Neill, he'd have to know when he's making these so-called reinitiation statements that everything before it has been suppressed. Right. He's acting under the belief that this is a legitimate interrogation and that this can be admitted against him. He doesn't know that as he's making those statements. Correct?
Correct. Absolutely. So, anyway.
Did the trial court rely on any part of the March 18th transcript in determining that the defendant had reinitiated the conversation with the officers?
Absolutely. They
right.
Quoted in.
So when you say that the entire statement was suppressed by the trial court didn't view that to be suppressed, that portion of it. Those few pages were that the court relied on, did it?
I think it did. I mean, you know, the trial judge's statement was never qualified other than to say that the March 18th statement is suppressed. He did not try to pick out one portion that wasn't suppressed.
What's in his? I don't have the order immediately before me. What was in the judge's order? Did he indicate he was suppressing the entire March 18th statement?
I don't know where the word entire was in there, but it does refer to suppressing that statement. So I'd have to look at it myself. Okay, so I'll conclude by saying that my position here is that reinitiation is not, in fact, the issue in the case because the questioning never stopped. And you can't reinitiate a questioning which has never stopped. So in this case, I would submit that clearly the defendant's Fifth Amendment rights were violated and that the March 19th statement should also have been suppressed.
Other questions, anyone?
No, Chief.
Thank you.
Mr. LaBeouf.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. I'll be brief, obviously. I'm going to start, as I always will when I'm here on behalf of the ACDL, by thanking this court for allowing us to be here, despite the implication that we might not have much to contribute here.
We're happy to have you. Go ahead.
I appreciate it, Chief. The concern of amicus in a case like this, that if this appeal is to be denied and this confession is to be upheld, the sort of mischief that it will lead to, what you will have is law enforcement officers simply plowing through the invocation of the right in the hopes that they will overbear the will of the confessor, build a rapport, and then you get the situation like you have with Mr. Rivas. Now they've been talking to him in a hospital bed for several hours. They built a rapport. They're talking. They're doing the things that law enforcement are okay to do. Maybe some things that they shouldn't has been suggested recently. But they're going to build that rapport. And so now you're interrupting it with a short medical examination. And if we're looking at attenuation, Your Honors, is it really attenuated if he's undergoing a medical examination? It's not as if he went back to his cell or back to the hospital bed, thought about it overnight, and found it in his heart to confess his wrongdoing. He was having a medical examination, but he had invoked his Fifth Amendment right, and I can't think of a more sacrosanct right than his right to counsel. Invocation without implementation is no invocation at all. They just plowed right through it. And if Mr. Smith's appeal is denied, that's going to continue to happen in the hopes that part of the statement may be suppressed and part might not. In the hope that if we build a rapport, this person will think we're his friend and he will take it upon himself to withdraw his invocation, even though nothing was done to implement it. He never got to speak to an attorney. So the right that he invoked was never actually implemented. I think Mr. Smith touched on it. It's his case, so I'm not going to accuse him of stealing my thunder a little bit, but they never should have been in the room. At the point it was determined, he invoked his right. What amicus would like to see is that serves as a magic talisman, akin to abracadabra. They should disappear. They should not have been in the room to get to the point where he might say, come back tomorrow and let's talk some more.
Had they done exactly that, is there a period of time during which the defendant could not have reinitiated? You said he didn't sleep overnight and so on.
Your Honor, I'm sure the cases regarding attenuation will tell you that some period of time is okay, and I'm not going to put a specific time parameter on it, but not certainly in the time that they're still in the same room with him.
If they had walked out of the room, a medical exam was conducted, as took place in this case, and then the transcript picked up, as it did, with them saying, we're leaving, and he then asks to speak. He allegedly reinitiates. Would that have been problematic under Edwards?
I believe it would have, Your Honor, because, again, the right that he invoked was never implemented. Had he had an opportunity to speak to an...
The medical is, he invokes, they stop questioning, a medical exam ensues. Can he reinitiate at that point?
Immediately after the medical examination? No, Your Honor, absolutely not. Because they're still there. They should not have been there.
I'll try it just once more.
Okay.
I walk out of the room. He then says, I want to talk to them. And they come back in. Still a problem.
So, Judge, are we still operating on the set of facts that happened here where they had talked to him for several hours, several hundred pages?
No. My question to you is, had they honored his invocation and walked out of the room, a medical exam ensued, and then he said, bring him back. I want to talk to you guys.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but that's certainly not what happened here, and that's certainly not what denying this appeal would invite, and that's the concern of amicus.
The hypothetical that the chief has given is what Edwards really suggests, and where the police honor the invocation, and then the defendant, with a free and unconstrained will, decides to reinitiate the question. That would be fine.
That would be better.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Oberholzer.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The defendant's argument is based on the premise that the reinitiation here occurred during the statement that was later suppressed. But the trial court found that defendant sought reinitiation after the initial tainted statement. And that is supported by credible evidence in the record, including the 35-minute medical examination that occurred. And contrary to defense counsel's arguments, there was no further questioning by defense counsel or by the detectives after that medical exam. The doctor left the room, and Detective Smith informed defendant that they were going to leave at that point twice, and then defendant asked them to return at least four times. I think possibly more than that, but four times clearly in that conversation that followed. So there had been, I'm sorry, I know it's hard to hear through the plexiglass. So there had been...
I'm sorry, I missed what you said.
So there had been they'd been a 35-minute break for the medical exam. During that medical exam, and in fact one time prior to that exam when I think a medical assistant, it's abbreviated MA in the transcript, had been in the room, defendant was there when two different people were told he would not be leaving the hospital. There would be no need to take him out of the hospital because they had gotten what they needed from him, the information they needed from him. And then the doctor left the room, and immediately thereafter, the detectives told defendant that they were leaving twice, and then defendant asked them to return four times without any additional interrogation, any questions from him before he asked them to return. So I think that the judge's determination that there had been a break in the interrogation and that the reinitiation occurred after the tainted statement is clearly supported by the record.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? When the doctor came in to examine him, the police officer remained, one police officer remained to act as his interpreter between the doctor and him?
It's not clear from, because it's only an audio, it's not clear, but it appears that Detective Guzman stayed in the room. It appears that the other two officers left the room. It's not clear if Detective Guzman was acting as an interpreter or was just staying in the room. There is one point where the doctor asks what happened, and Detective Guzman offers to answer that question so defendant doesn't have to go through it again.
Would it be fair to say that the defendant's understanding of English was limited?
He has certainly good conversational English, but he does occasionally, there are times when he answers questions in Spanish and times when he answers them in English.
And the detective was there during the entire medical examination and assisted at times to help him communicate with the doctor?
It's not clear if he's there to help communicate. There's no explanation as to why.
What was his presence there for?
It's not clear. There's no explanation.
Counsel, did you want to finish your 5 minutes?
I beg your pardon. I didn't realize that you invoked it.
That's okay. I don't mind.
I do.
That's all right. So because defendant reinitiated, there was no violation of Edwards, and the attenuation analysis is appropriate in this case. In determining that the statements were sufficiently attenuated, the court considered the 20-hour break between the two statements, the change in location, the fact that defendant had been medically cleared, including a psychological evaluation, and the fact that defendant waived his Miranda rights after not just a standard reading of Miranda, but the fact that he was advised that his consulate had offered to help him obtain private counsel at his parents' expense. This addressed his primary concern in waiving his Miranda rights on the previous day, which was that he was not confident in public defenders and he wasn't sure how much private counsel was going to cost him. Despite being advised of this, he was quite clear that he wanted to waive counsel and speak with the detectives on that day. The court also found that both on the 18th and the 19th, the detectives and Sergeant Smith had not engaged in any improper or coercive tactics that resulted in the waiver of defendant's Miranda rights. And this is a significant factor in the attenuation analysis because one of the primary reasons for suppression is to deter police misconduct. So based on that, the court would ask that this court affirm the lower court's ruling.
Are you arguing that the reinitiation dialogue is admissible?
Yes.
Okay. You were just talking about the attenuation.
Yes.
Okay. Assume there was a break, a 35-minute break. We would then have to determine whether or not the reinitiation conversation should be suppressed because of the cat out of the bag, fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, correct?
If it's not part of the...
Yes, okay. if there's a break.
Well,
then you would have to engage in the so-called attenuation analysis, and it would be pretty difficult, if not impossible, to argue that that 35-minute break where the police officers are still present in the room constitutes the sort of attenuation that has been recognized by our jurisprudence.
Well, is the state's position that even a suppressed statement can be used for purposes other than to prove a defendant?
Okay, so let's start. Should it be suppressed? Then you can argue whether or not the suppressed statement should still be admissible. Well, do you agree that any attenuation argument as applied to the reinitiation dialogue would necessarily require the suppression of that dialogue?
Well, no, because again, I don't think the police did anything wrong here, and I think that you would look at...
Let me ask you, picking up on the beginning...
I want her to answer that question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, again, because I think you have to look at whether the police did anything wrong here, and I don't think that they did. And I think the attenuation analysis, again, goes primarily to whether the statement would be admissible at trial, and...
Are you arguing they didn't do anything wrong from the beginning, that he didn't invoke his right to counsel?
Well, again, the trial court didn't find that he invoked his right to counsel.
Even ambiguous.
The trial court found that they didn't do anything wrong because they didn't engage in intentional misconduct.
Then why did he suppress the statement? They didn't do anything wrong.
Because he found that they should have asked further clarifying questions. The court did not find that he invoked his right to counsel.
Well, that under our law is required. If someone is ambiguously invoking the right to counsel, then the police either have to stop the interrogation or they have to ask additional clarifying questions. In the absence of that, anything that follows needs to be suppressed. Am I correct?
Yes, and it's an error, but it's not intentional misconduct.
Let me ask you, trying to understand the argument you noted at the beginning of your opening statement. The trial court seems to be differentiating here between the so-called statement and then the later conversation that followed the medical examination. And as I read it, tell me if I'm wrong about that, seem to view the statement to be everything, the Q&A preceding the medical examination, preceding the we're leaving statements. So when the trial court suppressed the statement, was the trial court suppressing everything on that transcript that happened thereafter? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Well, the trial court's opinion says that the reinitiation occurred after the tainted statement.
Right. So what I'm suggesting is that the suppression of the statement when the trial court suppressed the statement is not the entire transcript. Is that your argument?
Yes. Tainted statement is prior to the initiation.
There's a suppressed, tainted statement because of the ambiguous invocation of counsel. And then there is a second part of that transcript, much shorter, which is after doctor, possibly a second person, come in and the officer says, we're leaving. And that was not, in your view, suppressed by the trial court. That was viewed as something other than a statement.
So the 35-minute period during which the medical exam takes place, is that, in your judgment, a pure break from the questioning?
Yes.
How many officers were in the room during the 35 minutes?
Again, because it's an audio and not a video, it's not clear, but I believe only Detective Guzman was in the room.
At some point, while the doctor's in the room, is Sergeant Smith in the room as well?
I'm not clear on that.
So at the very outset of the doctor's entrance, and this is another question that goes to whether there's a pure break, the detective explains to the doctor in front of the defendant what's going on and says he had a big fight with his wife, he murdered his wife, he put her in a suitcase, dot, 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 then he tried to commit suicide in our jail cell.
Sergeant Smith, yeah.
Does that, it's Sergeant Smith who says that with to the doctor mm-hmm. in the room, does that cut against the argument that this was a pure break because the doctor is now gathering information about the crime in front of the defendant? Does that change the tenor of the medical examination?
Well, you're talking about at the top of page 385?
I am.
He asks the defendant if he'd like him to tell the doctor what happened. So I would argue probably not, because I think he's just offering to do it so the defendant doesn't have to.
Well, if you take a look at page 375, another instance where Detective Guzman appears to be helping with interpretation, the defendant is telling the doctor about using the meat tenderizer. So again, having a discussion with the doctor during this so-called break with one of the detectives in the room and talking about what happened with his wife. And Detective Guzman interjects to make clear that he's talking about using a meat tenderizer.
The doctor, is that the MA?
It says DR. She says, meat what? And Detective Guzman says, meat tenderizer or mallet. So they're having a discussion about the incident during this so-called break, correct?
This is part of the psychological exam, yes.
And going back to Detective Guzman, he's there to help him translate when the defendant is having difficulty understanding. Yes?
Yes.
Including, at one point, it made clear that he's from Uruguay.
Yes.
And that there was an ambassador, and then the ambassador's office or someone, representative of their government, communicated with his parents, and his parents were willing to pay for an attorney. But he seemed uncertain as to the role of the public defender and uncertain about whether he could get a lawyer. Am I correct?
Early on the 18th?
Yes.
Yes. Early on.
So did the judge make a specific finding that he understood what his right to counsel was?
I'm not entirely sure, no.
Okay. I'm looking at the judge's opinion at 56A. I'm trying to figure out precisely what was suppressed. I'm just going to read from the top of the page. The court finds Mr. Rivas's statements regarding the invocation of counsel equivocal and law enforcement's attempt to clarification insufficient. Accordingly, the court will suppress the statements made by Mr. Rivas during the interview conducted late in the afternoon and extended into the evening of March 18th. Are you on that page?
I am on that page.
And then the analysis begins with the March 19th statements. Doesn't that suggest that the entire March 18th statement has been suppressed?
I'm not clear, because again, the interview would be when they were questioning him.
Well, at least from that page of the opinion, it seems that the judge is suppressing the March 18th statement, because then he's moving on to the March 19th statement, correct?
Well, as I read it, the statements made during the interview would be when they were asking him questions.
Extending into the into the evening of March 18th. Was the evening of March 18th when the so-called reinitiation questions were occurring?
Well, yes, but it's when most of the interview was occurring.
He makes a reference to initiation of further communications with law enforcement after the initial tainted statement. That's the reference. Is that reference pertaining to those last few pages of the March 18th transcript?
The further communications?
Yeah, the further communications.
Yes, that would be the last.
So the concept being used by the judge here is there is a statement, which is the interview, all gone, all suppressed, and there is something that happened, a communication initiated by the defendant after the statement, still on March 18th.
Correct.
So when the judge suppressed the statement on March 18th, that's the interview.
And then the further communications are the reinitiation.
And if the judge had decided that to suppress the entire transcript, that would make no sense, correct?
Going back to Amicus's point about Edwards, in Edwards, the defendant, the police officers returned to question defendant, and it was not initiated by the defendant, and the Supreme Court was critical about that. What makes possible any initiation here is that the police remain in the room after the invocation of the right to counsel was made. So why should that be part of the taint that should be excluded? Because the so-called reinitiation was made possible only because police did not stop and leave.
But sometimes reinitiation occurs because police are transferred.
And what happened here? I don't know what happened some other times. What happened here?
Sometimes it could have happened if they returned the next day to transport him as well.
But it didn't.
It didn't. I understand that. It's a fact-specific case, but
this is not a pure Edwards or
it's not
case, because in those cases, the police honored the invocation of the right to counsel, and they did not go on and interrogate the defendant for hours. And then the question was whether or not, after the break in time, there was an appropriate reinitiation, correct?
Well, in Chu, they interrogated the defendant after his equivocal initiation of counsel.
I'm talking about the Edwards reinitiation, and at least in Wynn. Those are pure Edwards cases that don't involve confessions and the taint that follows the confession, correct?
Well, no, Chu did.
Okay, so what happened in Chu?
So in Chu, the defendant asked his mother about getting a lawyer in the presence of police. And the police interrogated him anyway.
It's a mother case. I'm talking about a right to counsel case.
Right, but they found that his comments to his mother in the presence of police constituted an equivocal invocation. You found that it constituted constituted an invocation of equivocal invocation of the right to counsel that should have been clarified before they questioned him. In
Chu, defendant asked to speak to his attorney, placed a call to his attorney wasn't there, and the interrogation ceased.
After questions had been asked.
Go ahead.
Was that true? I think both. Maybe I'm thinking of a different case. I might have the case wrong.
Do you at least concede that when there is an invocation of the right to counsel, whether it's ambiguous or direct, and there's an unlawful questioning, as occurred over here, even if there is a break, there must be a taint analysis, whether or not the unlawful confession tainted whatever statements followed?
Yes.
And are you suggesting that even if there were this so-called 35-minute break, that a taint analysis would result in the non-suppression of
the remaining statements?
But the reinitiation isn't what the taint analysis goes to. It's his subsequent, statement.
Why wouldn't it be? Because the question is whether or not, as a result of the confession, he thought the gig was up. The cat was out of the bag. Like, what's the point? Okay, I'll talk to you later. He had just confessed to the crime. That's the whole point of the cat out of the bag theory, that the person's will has already been overborne, and he's continuing to speak, right?
Well, that's why you look at whether the subsequent statement is tainted by that.
The cat out of the bag is about a statement right. where later the defendant provides information and the court rules know that was tainted by the prior unlawful interrogation in which he confessed. And therefore, that second confession is tainted under the, and there's an analysis of factors to right. get to that point, right? Is there a taint case where that you're aware of where the question is whether the cat out of the bag is not a statement by the defendant, but the defendant saying to the officers, I want to see you again?
No.
That's a new concept, right. isn't it? Am I missing
right.
something
no,
here?
Because the decision...
Why wouldn't it follow?
Because once defendant chooses to reinitiate, then then you look at whether... You apply that taint analysis to the second statement, and the circumstances of the reinitiation, and I'll go into that. You look at whether his waiver is knowing and voluntary.
Exactly. I mean, so the question is, after being interrogated for hours and confessing, whether or not after 35 minutes, the reinitiation was from a free and unconstrained will, untainted from the previous 3 hours. Are you suggesting that somehow within that 35-minute break period, he's forgotten everything that he said over the last 3 hours?
But that's why you look, when he gives the actual statement, you re-Mirandize him and look at all those circumstances.
Before the March 18th. Because you're using that as the reinitiation. Was he acting from a free will, or was he acting from the fact that he had been confessing for 3 hours when he said, okay, I'll see you guys again?
They didn't suggest it. He repeatedly asked them to come back. In fact, when they said, if we find her body, we'll take it from there. And he said, no, even if, I want you to come back, even if you find her body.
So look at it this way. Assume, not this case, assume there was no question but that a defendant's will had been overborne during extended questioning, and while still in that same frame of mind, the defendant says, I want to talk more with you, come back tomorrow, I'll talk with you then. And the officers come back and there's a full confession the next day. Is your position that the taint analysis only applies to the state of mind the next day and not to the initiation, the reinitiation, if it's clear that the person's will was overborne when he first said, come back tomorrow?
Well, if the question is that because it's so quick right on the heels, he feels his will is overborne at the moment, but he has 20 hours to think about it, and then that taint, that pressure can dissipate over that period of time.
But the officers can't even come back if the requested initiation, the reinitiation, is tainted, no?
Right, but...
You're erasing that from the analysis and saying, jump to what happens 20 hours later and only look there. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, because you can't read into the defendant's mind at that moment without... You know, this court said in Chu that you can't require renewed warnings prior to a defendant reinitiating because you don't know that he's going to do it. And the same sort of analysis, you can't preempt what a defendant's going to do. If he reinitiates, you can't stop him from doing that. And once he does, to expect, it's, you know, preempt every confession. You know, if it's defendants asking for the police to come back when the police haven't.
I thought one of your arguments was that the statement contained a lot of incriminating things, all of which were suppressed. The request to reinitiate was not an incriminating statement that was suppressed.
Right.
That's your argument. It's nothing about, I want to talk to you again, on its own incriminating. The court didn't find that it was incriminating. It's simply a request to reinitiate. And then 20 hours pass, however long time pass, they come back, they advise him, they've spoken to the consul, they advise him his family will pay for a lawyer, they advise him of Miranda, and then it starts again. So really, I guess what it comes down to is, what is the perception or understanding of the trial court's holding regarding suppression of admissions and the trial court's holding in our consideration of the request, come back tomorrow, come back tomorrow, come back tomorrow? I thought that kind of was your argument.
Yes.
Okay.
And your argument is that those are two different things. The admissions are suppressed under established law, ambiguous invocation, but the statements can be used by the court to determine whether there was a valid reinvocation.
Yes.
Anything else you'd like to present? Take a look at your notes. Go ahead.
I don't think so. I think we've covered everything, and I would just ask this court to respectfully to affirm the order below.
Sorry, I couldn't.
I'd just like to respectfully ask this court to affirm the order below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Smith, rebuttal.
Okay, I promised not to use more than my 2 minutes. First of all, I'd like to apologize to the court in the sense that I was not able to answer these questions about the medical break specifically. And the reason for that was that it wasn't argued by the prosecutor at the trial level. It wasn't argued by the Attorney General in her appellate division brief. And it wasn't argued by the Attorney General in her Supreme Court brief. So this idea of the medical break is something which basically I had no idea about until today. I would also note that in reference to the question of defendant wanting to talk to the police the next day, that the one thing that is missing from the appellate division opinion and missing from the Attorney General's presentation is that at the very end of the interrogation on page 397, defendant asks about his wife's funeral and says, that's why I want to talk to all of you. And then the police go back to saying, just before I leave, for instance, we're going to that house. Okay, are we wasting our time by going to that house, or is she definitely in that house? So clearly in my mind, there was no break. There was no change of topic. This interrogation continued until the very end of it, the discussion.
Mr. Smith, there's no need for you to apologize to us. You've been in front of us many times, and we know the level of your advocacy. My question, though, is to the extent your argument relies on the notion that questioning by officers was continuous and did not stop, is the medical examination relevant?
No, and it's not dispositive because the defendant didn't reinitiate.
Is it relevant?
To my recollection.
Is it relevant?
Well, I always think everything's relevant in these sort of cases. But
I'm sorry, if you could keep your voice.
Sorry. I think that everything is relevant in these sort of cases. But the fact is that this medical examination did not stop the questioning. It was just a pause in the proceedings, just as I said before, every time a nurse or the doctor walked in and out of the room. He was in a hospital. So.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Take the matter under advisement.